welcome to Good Evening, the Alfred Hitchcock Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella. And joining me, as always, are my ever-constant co-hosts, Tom Caldwell and Chris Haig. Tom, how's it going? That's a humongous cigar you've got there.
I may or may not have been in Cuba. I cannot confirm nor deny.
Mm-hmm.
Happy to be here with you guys.
They have nice cars in Cuba. Old cars.
Yeah.
Chris, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. I appear to have picked up this beautiful purple dress from somewhere. One previous owner, you know. It's nice.
Mm-hmm. Well, is there a hole in it?
I mean, now that you mention it, yeah, but that's how you get in the dress.
Oh, okay. Sounds good. Right on. Excellent. Well, we are here continuing on with our discussion on the Hitchcock films, and we're going to be discussing the 1969 film Topaz, otherwise known as, holy crap, that movie was a little bit too long, as, I think it'll be fun today. I think we'll have a good time. So, have you guys seen this before?
I have not.
Nor have I.
I may as well have not seen it, because I literally remembered nothing about this film. I've seen it once before, but I did not remember a thing, so this was basically a fresh wash for me. It's been so long since I've seen it, so.
Some context, it would have come out when I was 1 year old.
Oh, so you didn't see it in the theaters back then?
I might have. I was probably crying the whole time. I don't know.
To be fair, I was at a stage of watching the film as well, so we would have been in sync, Tom.
Yeah.
I think we've got a theme going on here. So excellent. Well, we're going to jump right into our discussion here. And which one of you fine gents is going to give us a quick little summary of this film of intrigue and cigars and French people and Russians and Cubans?
So, Topaz is a film about a French intelligence agent who becomes entangled in Cold War politics before the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis and then the breakup of an international Soviet spy ring. And a bit of a plot preview. And in Copenhagen in 1962, the high-ranking Soviet intelligence officer, Kusinov, defects to the West, and during a debriefing, a CIA agent named Mike Nordstrom learns that Soviet missiles with nuclear warheads will be placed in Cuba. So it's somewhat based on real life. It's interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty timely, though, to have this movie for us talking about it right now with what's going on over in Europe. So
yeah, I mean,
interesting.
It's rare that we get political on the show, but it is, you know, the timing is quite interesting.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, right on. Well, I'm just going to jump right into my facts here. So Topaz is a 1969 American espionage thriller directed by Hitchcock, and it's based on the 1967 novel of the same name by Leon Uris. Now, the story is loosely based on the 1962 Sapphire Affair, which involved the head of France's SDECE in the United States. The spy Philip Thiroux de Vosjoli, a friend of Uris, who played an important role in helping the U.S. discover the presence of Russian offensive missiles in Cuba. Now, the film was released on December 19th, and it had an actual theatrical cut run of 127 minutes and an extended cut of 143. Now, I watched the 143-minute version, and I think this definitely could have been trimmed down. But that's interesting that there's a few different... I'll go into some of the different versions of it here. But it had a budget of $6 million, and it only raked in $6 million at the box office. So this was not a major critical success for Mr. Hitchcock. Now, I'll start with the Cuban Missile Crisis. I got a little bit about that as relevant for what's going on in the film, kind of like the last one there with Torn Curtain. The Cuban Missile Crisis is also known as the October Crisis of 1962 in Cuba and the Caribbean Crisis in Russia, or the Missile Scare. It was a 35-day confrontation between the United States and the Soviet Union, which went from October 16th to November 20th of 1962, and it escalated into international crisis when American deployments of missiles in Italy and Turkey were matched by Soviet deployments of similar ballistic missiles in Cuba. Despite the short time frame, the Cuban Missile Crisis remains a defining moment in national security and nuclear war preparation. The confrontation is often considered the closest the Cold War came to escalating into a full-scale nuclear war. Now, following the critical and commercial failure of Torn Curtain, Hitchcock initially spent over a year developing ideas for what was titled variously as Kaleidoscope or Frenzy. Several writers worked on the project, including Ben Levy, Howard Fast, and novelist Hugh Wheeler, before Universal's Lou Wasserman persuaded Hitchcock to put it to the side in favor of something more commercial. After browsing through the studio's available properties, Hitchcock eventually settled on Urus's 1967 Cold War thriller, and Universal was keen to develop a blockbuster with an international cast, so they set a budget of $4 million, which was the largest budget for any Hitchcock film to date. The original cut of the film ended with a duel between André and Jacques in a French football stadium. It was shot by producer Herbert Coleman when Hitchcock had to return to the United States for a family emergency. Audiences panned the ending during test screenings. They also said the film was far too long. Under pressure from the studio, Hitchcock shot a second ending that he actually liked better, with Jacques escaping on an Aeroflot flight to the Soviet Union as André and Nicole boarded their adjacent Pan Am flight back to the United States. However, the ending apparently confused audiences. Also, screenwriter Taylor objected to the villain escaping unpunished, and there were fears that the ending would offend the French government. As a compromise, Hitchcock used existing footage to create a third ending in which Granville is exposed and expelled from a NATO meeting. Over a shot of the exterior of his apartment, the sound of a gunshot tells that he commits suicide behind his drawn curtains, since no footage of his suicide existed. The film was released with this third ending and was also edited down by nearly 20 minutes to a final length of 127 minutes. The airport ending briefly appeared on British prints of the film by mistake, but those prints were soon altered to match the version that was released elsewhere. The 143-minute cut of the film was released for the first time by Universal on DVD in 1999. It used the second ending, in which Jacques escapes, and all three endings appear as extras on the DVD, together with an appreciation by Leonard Maltin, in which Maltin discusses the deleted scenes and the alternate endings. The longer version of the film has been released numerous times on DVD and Blu-ray in the US and in many other markets. However, some markets like Germany, Japan, and Scandinavia continue to have the shorter theatrical cut on DVD and Blu-ray. Hitchcock's signature cameo appearance occurs around 28 minutes into the film. At the airport, he's seated in a wheelchair and is being pushed by a nurse. She stops, and he nonchalantly stands and greets a man and proceeds to walk off screen with him. Now, as for the actors, Frederick Stafford was a Czechoslovakian-born actor, and he was born Frederick Strobel von Stein. He spoke fluent Czech, German, English, French, and Italian, and was a leading man in European spy movies. Danny Robin was a French actress of the 50s and the 60s, and Robin was born Danielle Robin in Clamart. She performed with Peter Sellers in The Waltz of Toreadors and co-starred opposite Kirk Douglas in the 1953 romantic drama Act of Love. Karen Dorr was a German actress, and she was famous to international audiences for her role as Bond girl Helga Brandt in the James Bond film You Only Live Twice, and she was well-known for her role here in Topaz. And finally, John Keith Vernon was a Canadian actor, and he made a career in Hollywood after achieving initial television stardom in Canada. He was best known for playing Dean Warmer in Animal House, the mayor in Dirty Harry, and Fletcher in The Outlaw Josie Wales. And that is what I've got for my facts. Let us jump in to the discussion of the film. Who'd like to take it away?
I don't mind starting off, and I think my general impression of the film, a lot of people talk about it being a complicated storyline to follow, and I kind of agree with that, but I want to say, and this isn't necessarily a bad thing, it really comes across to me like a American TV drama, and a lot of that, I think, is the lighting, the cinematography is very television-ish. And I can't avoid, with John Forsythe being in the film, thinking of Dynasty, Charlie's Angels, and things like that, and having that really heavy American TV feel to the film. which is distracting, and obviously it's a big American political story too. And yeah, the version I watched, 2 hours 20 minutes, it really did kind of go on and on for me. Again, I'm happy to have watched it because it's important that we look at each film individually, but not necessarily a highlight film for me of the Hitchcock films.
Chris, what are your initial thoughts here?
Man, I tried with this film. I mean, listen, I messaged you guys and I was like, I'm having to do this in chunks. You know, like a 2 hour, like for reference, this is the same week I went and saw the new Scream film, which is only about 20 minutes shorter, and yet it feels, that flew by. Whereas with this, it was a bit more of a labour. I could appreciate some elements of it, I will say this. I think it's shot quite well. I do appreciate the performances and everything, but for me, the plot is like, it's like trying to swim through treacle. Mm-hmm. And it needed to be shorter. It so needed to be shorter.
Mm-hmm.
Because I understand, obviously, it's got this real-world influence. It's a partial adaptation of the, I believe you said it was the Sapphire Affair,
mm-hmm.
which obviously Sapphire, Topaz, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I think there could have been some real trimming, and I think there could have been some real cutting down of plot stuff. Because, I mean, something that we've seen with Hitch as he's gotten older is that the films have got kind of longer and longer and longer, and that sort of tautness, I think, has left a lot of his films as he's entered the later stages of his career, which is a shame. There's nothing, you know, it's not a bad idea in itself that, okay, now he's got the breathing room, he's being edited less, he's got time to breathe and all that sort of thing. But the problem is, when you've got something like this, you have a handful of really great scenes sort of buried in a bit of a stodge of a plot. So it didn't work for me personally, but again, I can really appreciate what the film, you know, what it's about, and kind of, you know, it is a bit of Hitch going to, you know, back to the true crime, which is he's touched on previously in, and I can't remember the name of the film. It's the one with the priest, and it's based on something.
I Confess.
Oh, no, it's not. It's not the. No, I got them. There's I Confess, and then it's the one where it's partially based on the true thing, where it's the guy who's getting arrested.
Oh, the not the innocent man. I know what you mean. The trombone player guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know which one you're talking about. I'm just drawing a blank on it on top of my head here.
Can
the
you
wrong,
tell, can
the
you
wrong
tell
man. Is that the wrong man? The wrong man, isn't
I think
it?
Yeah, the wrong man. Sure. Which is him adapting something into a sort of docudrama kind of inspiration kind of way. So it's similar in that sort of tone. Obviously, this is a bit more international. It has that sort of torn curtain, international, European flavour of things. But yeah, ultimately, this didn't really work for me, mm-hmm. sadly.
So, like, myself, I'm not big for spy movies. Like, I'm not a huge James Bond fan or anything like that. You know, this has never really been my cup of tea. But, like, this movie had a lot of really good, you know, little chestnut of ideas that were really good. But just the whole execution of the film, it was just something was missing. And maybe that was it was too long. Maybe it just wasn't, like, detailed enough. But, I mean, like, the sequence in Harlem was, like, amazing, right? Where they're trying to get the suitcase and they're running through the streets. I like the idea of, you know, that Cuban guy's right-hand man, the red-headed guy, recognizing him and him catching on that he was lying to him about being in New York and when he finally got to Cuba. And I like the idea of he's this French guy that works for his government, but he's got all these, you know, what's the word? Not agents, but like assets. That's what I'm looking for. Assets, like all over how this.
The resistance.
Yeah.
Right?
The resistance. This Cuban leader. She's like this really famous woman who's actually in charge of the resistance. Like, there's a lot of really wonderful nuggets in this film. But I mean, like, sitting here talking to you guys, I'm like, yeah, but there was these really great sequences in the film. And I'm like, holy crap, what sequences were those? Like, I just watched this thing yesterday morning. And I'm like, it's already, like, leaving my head. I remember the Harlem sequence, and I remember that there was another really outstanding sequence, But now I can't remember what that second sequence was.
The picnickers taking the photograph over the hill in Cuba of the shipyard was very intriguing. Where they hid the camera in the sandwiches, and then the gulls actually give them away because the gulls fly overhead with these emptied loaves of bread, and then there's a rush of gulls that come from the hill, and that's where the Cuban soldiers detected the spies on the hill and chased them and caught them. That was very exciting. And that bird's touch, right? A little bit of birds in there with the gulls revealing, giving away the location of the spies on the hill.
Is this Guantanamo Bay or Bodega Bay? Yeah. I can't remember. So, I'm used to Hitchcock using, like, rear projection and whatnot and, like, process photography and stuff, but there was a couple of moments in this film where I'm like, dude, what are you doing? Like, that gull sequence when they're, like, looking up from below and they're trying to push the birds away, and those really bad process photography gulls, four of them fly up. Like, they're just way too big. It doesn't look good. And there's that sequence where he's sitting there on the some guy's sitting on the train, and he's supposed to be reading the newspaper. But it's like process photography over top of him. And then the guy's sitting there, but he zooms in on the camera. Or sorry, he takes the camera and zooms it in on the paper, but it's just like an enlargement of it. And it's like a really, really crappy shot. It's really bad. And I don't know why he had to do it that way, but it's like, Hitchcock, what are you doing? He's like, for me, he's losing his touch on this film here.
Just a quick aside, a bit of a tangent, if you don't mind, because you were talking about the scene in Harlem. Is this not one of the first times that there's been a major character who's a black actor? With Roscoe the florist, who's a very interesting character. Like, there's a lot going on there where he's got that flower shop, and then he turns into the spy, and he's really integral to the success of that scene where they get the photographs of the secret document taken. But I think that's probably one of the first really prominent black characters in a Hitchcock film.
Yeah, I think you're right. So we won't count it's Young and Innocent because that was just blackface. So,
less. Dear listeners, go back and listen to our Young and Innocent episode where we kind of go through all that. I mean, funnily enough, when you're talking about Bond, the sequence in Harlem, which is amazing, and you know, you're absolutely right, Tom, talking about the florist. It reminds me so much of, and it is because of the setting, but the way it's like, oh, it's a secret spy ring, that sort of thing. Anyone who has seen Bond or likes Bond, it reminds me so much of Live and Let Die, because there's a whole sort of like the first third of the film is really focused in Harlem in New York for various kind of plot reasons.
Yeah, okay.
And there's this whole idea of this sort of spy network working for the bad guy, and it's like people who are shining shoes are spies, and people in tarot shops are spies, and in bars, and it's this whole thing, and it just reminded me so much of it. So I wouldn't be surprised if the directors or the producers tapped that as a bit of an influence or an inspiration, because it just reminded me so much of that particular sequence.
Yeah, I haven't seen many Bond films. I've seen all the Craigs except the new one. I've seen the first three Connery ones, and I've seen a couple of the Brosnan ones. I think two or three of the Brosnan ones. So,
yeah.
But I don't know. Like, I don't know. I just wish I could remember now what the other sequence is. What was the other amazing sequence in the film? Was there anything that you guys could think of?
The purple dress scene got me, which is the scene where Parra, I think his name is. He basically learns that Juanita is the leader of this underground resistance, and he's detailing it, and he's got her held very close, and it's almost romantic, and he's describing all the ways that, you know, oh, well, I'm not just going to let you go, I can't forgive you, the things they're going to do to you are indescribable, and she's getting upset, and it's this weird, dark, romantic moment where he basically spares her by shooting her dead. Mm-hmm. And there's the shot of her falling in this. For UK listeners, it's like Cadbury purple. I don't know if they've got Cadbury in Canada. They might do. But it's a very specific shade of purple that just, you know, is this. It's a very iconic, beautiful dress. But it was just this whole sequence, this really dark. It's just like a really dark, romantic moment in the middle of this middling spy film, and I was like, oh wow, that actually stuck with me. That was quite a powerful scene between these two actors that I really enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Chris, I have a Cadbury Cream Egg on my desk as my emergency sugar supply. but the cinematography of that scene where they go into the aerial shot as she falls to the ground and her dress floods what is really a chessboard of tile.
Yep.
That's a beautiful, beautiful moment of cinematography where the life...
That is the shot I think of with this film.
The purple dress pours onto the ground as her life leaves her body. Like, that was an amazing moment. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really, if people just Google that video clip and enjoy that video clip, if that's...
Yeah.
If that's something you'd like to enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would recommend, if nothing else, if you don't want to watch the whole film, I would look up that sequence just because it's so well shot. And like Tom said, that shot is absolutely stunning. There is something it reminds me of, but I can't think what it is. Yeah, it's just so...
And what a romantic moment, too, where he literally... Like, you just recapping what you said, he threatens her with torture and the reality of this is what's going to happen, and then he saves her that fate by killing her. Like, that's an amazing... Yeah,
he literally saves her from a fate worse
moment,
than death.
Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, from what is, you know, she is a... well, no, she's not really a tertiary character because she's Andre's... I am right in saying she's Andre's mistress.
That is correct.
Yeah. I've got that. Thank God. I was, because part of the issue I have is that, you know, Andre is sort of the main character. Well, he is ostensibly, but you do follow other characters around and get their perspectives and all that kind of stuff. I really did not side with Andre, mainly because when it was like, oh, you're having an affair, and I'm like, it's a weird thing of mine. I don't really like cheating in films, and the idea that, oh well, you know, he's fallen in love with Juanita and, you know, he's been cheating on his wife with her. It never really sat right with me, but I can understand if other people find Andre and Juanita's relationship quite romantic.
Is that going to bed with each other in the purpose of furthering the spy work, though?
No, they're definitely having an affair as well. Like,
yeah, like it could argue that, oh well, it started off as like this clandestine thing and then it became romantic, but I think it's not just a, you know, like a, I don't know what you'd call it, like a tactical relationship. I think there is some genuine real emotion there. But I have to give, is it Karen, who was it? It was Karen Dorr. Karen Dorr, who played Juanita, who again I know from Bond. She plays a very good secondary villain in You Only Live Twice, and that's where I sort of recognised her. I went, oh cool, you're from thingy. She plays what could be quite an awkward role with just real... She has one of the best performances for me in this, and I just really enjoyed it.
So I took a look at on the Hitchcock Zone. They have the 1,000 frames of a movie. Like, they put about a bunch of stills from the movie. And the other sequence I was thinking of was the opening one when they're going through like that porcelain factory.
Oh yeah,
that was really good too. Really very suspenseful. So it was a great way to start the film. So again, yeah, lots of really good stuff in here. Just a shame that it didn't really stick the landing. One of the most interesting things that I thought about it, though, was for one of the characters, the antagonist there, Henri Jarre, having a cane, like having that arm brace cane and whatnot. Like, I don't know what would cause him to need that one, but like, what a unique trait for a character to have.
And you're right away thinking, is this real or is this some kind of a cover? Because everything is spy world, right? So is this some kind of fakery that he's doing? Is that going to be a rifle in his cane? You know, like, is he able to walk or is he not able to walk? But yeah, it was an interesting character trait for sure.
Now, Tom, you'd mentioned before we started recording, you wanted to talk about some of the behind the scenes. You want to jump into that? Unless, Chris, is there anything else about the movie in particular that you wanted to talk about?
No, I mean, the thing with the endings is interesting, although I don't know if that's going to be covered in this next section.
I didn't get a chance to watch the alternate endings. I've had a pretty bonkers weekend here. I was going to, but I know that they're on my Blu-ray that I've gotten that set.
Yeah. It's quite Because they are also on YouTube for anyone who wants to, who doesn't have the Blu-ray. They are on YouTube. You can find them.
Oh, did you watch them?
Yeah, I've seen them.
Oh, good, good, good.
One of them is wild. One of them is one of the, not funny, but most out of pocket. I was like, oh, wow, okay, this is happening. So the the original ending, as you might have mentioned, is a duel, which apparently that's a thing. And I'm like, right, okay, this is a duel that's happening between Andre and Granville, is it? Yeah, I think. Mm-hmm. So it happens in this like empty football stadium. Of all reasons, and it's truly like you can tell it's Hitchcock because there's like POV shots of the gun, and there's, you know, it's absolutely mad sequence, and then Granville randomly gets shot in the back by a sniper, and I was okay. Like, I went, oh, and it was well as well because obviously Nicole, it turns out that Nicole, who is Andre's wife, she and Granville are a thing. It's this is a total aside. It's going to be really weird for anyone British hearing me saying the name Granville when it's a real reference to a sitcom thing. Anyone British who's listening, I know it's weird. I'm sorry. But the whole sequence of the stadium is just, it's bizarre, but it's the idea of like, oh, well, we're going to solve spycraft with a drum pistols duel. It's completely mad. And then the other one is this... it's a weird crossfade thing where Granville, he basically goes to this NATO meeting and they expel him because he's like, yo, you're a spy, you're a traitor, all that sort of thing. You then get crossfades of everyone who's died. So you get like, you know, is it Ja who they fake his suicide? They sort of throw him out of his building and he's there on the car. And it's like they crossfade that, they crossfade Juanita in the purple dress. They do all these little sort of like... It's almost like it's a dream sequence, like do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And then all you see is him walk into his apartment, it holds on it, and then you hear a shot. And that is how it ends.
Nice.
That's it. So the original ending obviously is the one where it, you know, he flees to the Soviet Union. There's Andre and Nicole on the steps on the other plane because they're going back to, you know, their own home. And it's just, I don't think there was a really satisfactory way for any ending for this, which is a shame. But it was just mad. It was truly seeing, you know, the villain get shot in the back by a random sniper is one of the weirdest ways I've ever seen a film end. So that's all I have to say.
Oh, I can't wait to check those out. I'll probably watch them tonight here. But I just
they are worth a view.
See, that's what I always expected when I first got DVDs, right, back in the early 2000s, and they're talking about, oh, alternate endings and whatnot. I'm like, oh, wow, this is cool. We're going to see some crazy stuff. Like, you know, you watch Bambi, and instead of, like, him having a baby, he picks up a machine gun and starts killing all the hunters, right? You know, like, that's what you'd expect. That's basically what we got here is literally three completely different alternative endings. That's bizarre. So
the only one that I know of recently, and it came out either last year or the year before, if there's any horror film fans, so there's this series called Escape Room. There's a sequel called Tournament of Champions, and there's a version on the Blu-ray DVD which basically rewrites the last third of the film. So it's not just an ending, it basically goes haha, and it even has, I think this is genius, they have a child actor who plays one character in one version and a completely different character in the other version. Both really important characters, but they basically go, they've essentially gone, oh, well, we really like this kid actor. Let's just keep them for whichever version. It is truly bizarre. It is weird. But it's quite fun to try and talk about it with people. So it's that kind of stuff you're expecting on a home release, really, going like, oh, and here's a different, you know, imagine a version of Psycho where, spoiler alert, Marion didn't die. And you're like, what?
Or what if it was actually his mom? His mom didn't die.
Yeah. Third act, it turns out she kills Norman, and then it's like a supernatural kind of story. You know, imagine all the things we could have had if they'd just said, tell you what, we'll give you an extra, you know, 50 grand, write a completely bonkers ending, and then someday at home release, someone's going to watch it on DVD, and they'll talk about it on a podcast.
Yeah. That's funny. Tom, you didn't get a chance to watch the alternate endings, did you?
No, I just stuck to the one.
Okay.
But now there's some take-home homework for me to check those out.
Yes. Do it. I mean, to be fair, I think you still have to watch Blackmail. I don't think you ever did watch that one, did you?
I think there's probably two or three that in my laziness during the production of our podcast, I might have skipped out those days of work, and I have to...
Yeah, you weren't available for the recording, so you're like, I'm just not going to watch the movie.
You were there like, oh, I'm unavailable. I can't do it. And you were there just going like, I'm not watching this dross.
You'd think you'd pick that for, like, this movie then or something, right? I'm not available to talk about this one. Tom, anyways, why don't you jump into your behind-the-scenes
stuff there's
what you talk about there.
One of the books here by Thomas Leach, he talks about... despite a massive publicity push by Universal Pictures and tons of interviews and press done by the director and a National Board of Review award for Best Director of 1969 for work on this film, Topaz really did flop with the press and in the public, losing more money than any other Hitchcock film. And it has never been re-released by the studio and is unknown except to Hitchcock scholars. So I take that as a compliment that we are some kind of a scholar. But John Forsythe, the actor, said that during the filming, Hitchcock was no longer the great brain that sat in the chair watching. He would go away for 15 or 20 minutes, lay down, have naps. It was sad to see. There was at least one occasion where he fell asleep during a take, and nobody was brave enough to wake him. So I think Hitchcock in this era is, his health is not 100%. He is waning a little bit as a director, but I think this film had a lot of bad, you know, a lot of controversy, studio fights and things going on behind the scenes. So it is an unfortunate example of one film later in the work of Hitchcock that had a lot of issues and had some problems and wasn't necessarily that popular.
Well, this is two in a row now, because Torn Curtain doesn't have a lot of fair critical reception either. And I mean, like, we're going to get into it. I think it's the next one. I think it's Frenzy, where it's the Strangler or whatever is the next one. Like, I know that, like, going into it, I think that the iconic tongue sticking out of the dead bodies and whatnot, I think it's really stupid. So going ahead of time into that movie here. So, like, I think Hitchcock is on the downward spiral here, which is unfortunate because he's not like that old at this time. You know, I think if I remember correctly, like, he's born in 1899 and this was 1968. So he's only 69 when he's making this movie, right? I mean, now he's never been in the best of shape and whatnot. Like, he's not a Martin Scorsese or anything like this, right? But, I mean, he's only 69 when he's making this movie here, so.
And if I could touch on this very quickly, I found an interesting article in a 1981 edition of Rolling Stone magazine, and it is the writer, James Toback. Now, to be fair, this is a very critical article where he refers to the great directors and also Hitchcock. He doesn't really come across like a huge fan. Now, considering this is 1969, the end of the sexual revolution, and in all of the previous films, Hitchcock has had a lot of pushback about love scenes and things like that. But in this film, which is practically released in the 70s, the romantic scenes, the kissing scenes, are still very dry and boring. Now, is this because Hitchcock is just used to doing it that way, or he didn't want to progress? But this writer in Rolling Stone talks about the great mystery of experience. The closest taste of death available in life in a Hitchcock film is the watered-down, castrated attempts at adventure. There isn't a single scene in any Hitchcock film in which we can feel that any man has anything approaching a legitimate erection, or that any woman is feeling desire in any cell of her body, south of her brain. So this is very, I think this writer is very, very direct in his criticism of Hitchcock. But is this a fair critique of the love scenes in this film, where again, the kissing is just very boring, closed mouth kissing. There's no real passion shown. So is that to be expected, or should we, of that era from 1969, expected more from the films in that regard?
I think that at that time, you would definitely be getting some more risque stuff in films, but I don't have a problem with Hitchcock not going that route. I mean, he's been making movies since, you know, the late teens, early 20s. He's been working on films, right? He's been directing since the mid-20s, and that's how films were done then, and so he's got his style. He's very much in his ways. Like, this feels like a Hitchcock film through and through, from the process photography to the way the sets look, to the way the costume design looks, to the way the people are acting. Like, this is a Hitchcock film through and through. So I don't have a problem with him not going more for the sex scenes, because that's how he's done it since the beginning. Like, I don't remember a single crazy erotic sex scene, or like even anything more than just kissing, since the start of his films, right? Because that's how he just did it. That's how he was raised on it. That's how he learned. That's how he, you know, carved his mark in the world. And so it doesn't bother me that that's all that there is. I didn't think about it when I was watching these movies. So
yeah, that's a fair point. It might be too hard for him as an established director to change his ways that late in his career.
See, like, I guess since you mentioned it too, I didn't think about it, but Psycho, he had that scene where she was in her bra, and I guess that was pretty provocative for 1960, right? Her walking around in a bra. Yeah.
Hitchcock has said that he shoots a love scene like a murder scene and a murder scene like a love scene. And he's famous for the murder scenes happening off camera, so maybe that's his approach also to the love scenes, is that everything happens off camera. But again, he is a Victorian man, right? Literally. Yeah. So I thought it was an interesting, the article I think from Rolling Stone was a little overboard in being negative, considering it was also the same edition of Rolling Stone magazine where they did his memorial. But it's always interesting to read the different critics and the different points of view. Again, I would recommend, you know, if you want to really be a dedicated Hitchcock fan, make sure to watch this to say that you've seen them all.
I think that we should appreciate this film more, and in order to do that, we should turn this podcast into a Topaz Minute, and we'll just go through this film minute by minute, and every minute of the film we'll make a new podcast episode. What do you guys think?
Sure, an extra 10 episodes.
10 episodes? No, extra 122 episodes. So, what do you think, Chris? Topaz Minute?
Listen, I love you guys. I love you guys like brothers. I would sooner get shot in the foot than do that. There are much better films we could do a minute podcast on. I would happily, like, a minute of Psycho, a minute of The Birds, you know.
Juno and the Paycock? Okay, excellent.
This is a family-friendly podcast, Brandon. I'm not allowed to use the words I'd like to use.
Okay, so, Tom, out of a 1 5-inch cigar, how much of this cigar did you smoke? Out of 5?
What? I'm confused. I give this 2 out of 5. Why are those cigars so green? Shouldn't they be brown?
What the hell is up with those cigars? Why are they so green? This is like raw. Is he smoking raw cigars? Every cigar I've ever seen is brown.
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Raw green cigars. It's like he's just smoking a leaf. Just ripped it off the tree, rolled it up, started smoking. Chris, how many cigars is this out of 5?
Oh, 2.5 cigars out of the 5.
2.5. I give it 3. So I was like watching this the first hour. I'm like, you know what? This is really good. I'm going to give this a 4. And then I'm like, it just fell apart. Like, the back half of this film is just so long. So it dropped to a star for me. I gave it 3. So I'm fine with that. So anywho. We're going to wrap it up here. So you guys know where to find us. Listen to every other episode. You know where to find us. Thanks to Jason for creating our wonderful theme music, Jason Cullimore. And thanks to the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting us. Don't forget to check out our friends Annie and Catherine and their show Good Evening Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast. They're on a bit of a hiatus right now. But you can go into their back catalog as well as ours. So, next time we're going to be covering Frenzy as we rapidly approach the end of our Hitchcock run. But until then, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.